Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is photographer Jim Richardson, a longtime photographer for National Geographic magazine and a contributing editor to Nat Geo's companion magazine, Traveler. Over the years, he's photographed over 25 stories for the magazines on assignments that have taken him around the world, but mainly throughout the American West. Richardson says his goal is to capture the medium between the glorious sunset and the unbridled greed of the American West, which he has captured in stories on the Great Salt Lake, the Colorado River, the Colorado Front Range, the California Trail, Cascadia, the Ogallala Aquifer, and the vanishing dark skies of the West. In addition to his work for National Geographic, Richardson has built a distinguished body of work of black and white documentary photographs about rural Kansas. For 30 years, he's been photographing daily life in the small town of Cuba, Kansas. And his 1979 study of adolescence, High School USA, is now considered a photo essay classic. Two of his images are part of the National Geographic's Greatest Photographs of the American West, which is on display at Gilcrease Museum through February 3rd. He was a guest of the museum last Friday, and I spoke with him while he was in town. Jim Richardson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be here in Tulsa.
We can see several of your works in the National Geographic show, which is currently on display at Gilcrease Museum, but you've had a long career with National Geographic. I think, 25 articles that you've
photographed? Yeah, it's been 28 years now since my first story appeared in the magazine.
How did you first get started with National Geographic?
Well, I had been a newspaper photographer for a good 15 years before that, and that's where I really got my start. And during that time, started doing more extended stories, longer projects, books,
sort of photographic essays,
yeah.
That sort of thing.
And then when I started freelancing, basically I was well-suited to the kind of things that National Geographic needed done. When I started freelancing, I was working for Time and Newsweek and Sports Illustrated and all the rest. But it was really my interest in getting in deeply into stories that lent my talents to what National Geographic needed done. And so it was really a rather easy transition into it.
One of the things National Geographic is known for, and what you seem to be known for as well, is a mix between photographing the natural and sort of a social documentary style. Mm-hmm. I assume that sort of goes with just about any story National Geographic does about the natural world. They're looking at how the natural world is had an impact from humans, mm-hmm. and how the natural landscape impacts humans.
Can do. And obviously we have natural history stories, we have wildlife stories, as well as cultural, archaeological, stories that fit into categories. But when you come to, say, what you might call a resource story, a story, say, about the Colorado River or the Columbia River or something like that, then you can go the full range from pure landscapes of the Grand Canyon to law courts where people are haggling over water law, to recreation where people are putting a heavy burden on the resource, like the Colorado, out on some Labor Day party on Copper Canyon, say, on the Colorado River. You can do the whole gamut. So for those kinds of stories, then it's not just one kind of photography. And it's best if you have a photographer who can cover that whole range, because it doesn't necessarily then shoehorn the story into the expertise of the photographer.
So on a story like the Colorado River, you're up near the headlands, I would assume, mm-hmm. in the middle of the Utah canyons, which are, of course, these are incredible scenery. You're covering the canals. I would assume if you're really doing a story on Colorado River water, mm-hmm. you're going to Vegas and seeing the fountains of Vegas. You're
yep.
seeing the aquifers going to Phoenix or to Los Angeles.
That's right.
And everything in between.
All of the above. And it really is an intellectual exercise as well as a visual exercise, because you have to figure out what's interesting. I mean, you always have to be interesting. And what's the balance? What are the major themes? And then once you understand those themes, where are you going to find the pictures to do them? And what are you going to bring to it that hasn't been done over and over and over again?
In fact, in that Colorado River story, you take a picture of Hoover Dam, mm-hmm. which, of course, has been documented over and over. Ansel Adams has the classic view of that.
Sure.
And you had to come up with a different view, and you came up with a pretty interesting solution.
Yeah, I had looked at many pictures of Hoover Dam, just partly because I needed to familiarize myself with what was out there, what was good, and what any potential picture would have to be to one-up the ante, if you will. And at the time, I kind of realized that technology, film, lenses, and everything were just at the place where I could probably get up in a helicopter and shoot Hoover Dam after dark from the air. And there was great advantage in doing that because you could not only just see Hoover Dam, but you could see the surrounding landscape, that vast
dry
desert in the evening light, Lake Mead stretching off into this dry landscape of the American West, and this, more important, this dam shining like a jewel in that landscape, all lit up, looking beautiful, a real gem in the whole world of the water managers of the American West. That's where that picture had to fit into the whole landscape.
And, of course, you do. You capture it. You had floodlights on the dam. It's, I guess, right at dusk, maybe even a little after dusk.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting, the wide of the dam actually accents the bathtub ring that's so part of Lake Mead because the water bleaches that red rock white.
That's right. That's right. And as the demands on the Colorado River exceed supply, then you see that water line dropping further and further and leaving more of that bleached rock to be shown. And that gives added depth to the picture. It gives you something to talk about in the captions, or as we call them, National Geographic legends, to give us the chance to let our readers inside a bit more, to bring context, bring background, to bring understanding.
Right. And now on a story like that, as opposed to, say, something like the California Trail. The California Trail, you were sort of recreating vistas that maybe pioneers would have seen in a 20th century situation where there are power lines and highways crisscrossing that California Trail. But in the case of the Colorado River, you're working also with a writer who is writing about all these issues. Mm-hmm. How closely do you work with the writer in coming up with your photographic narrative, you know, along with the story?
It's much more in parallel than in lockstep. And usually what would happen there is for our magazine would be that the whole project would start with a story proposal. By story proposal, I don't mean the words necessarily. I mean the overall editorial emphasis.
We want to look at the Colorado River.
Right, yeah, right. Uh-huh. And then each of us, the writer and the photographer assigned to the story, would then each design a coverage plan that would attempt to tell the story. And really what should happen, ideally, is the writer is going to do in words what words do well, and I will do in pictures what pictures do well. And we will do parallel dialogue, parallel narrative, and in some places it will be hand in glove that we went to the same place. In other places, it will be that the writer is covering a particular issue, and I'm covering the same issue, but the writer finds some expert to talk about it, and I want to go see it. And it's not necessarily at the same place at the same time. So I want, as a photographer for National Geographic, I want to be unencumbered by the necessity of compromising a picture simply because it happens to be a paragraph or two in the story. If the issue is important, I'll cover it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll try and find the best place to bring our readers the best picture possible of that. And I'll let the writer do what they do well
now,
and talk about it.
If you get an incredible photograph that perhaps is not a part of the narrative, does that become a part of the story?
If it's truly not part of the narrative of our story.
You shouldn't have taken the picture.
It doesn't run.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
I mean, and there are plenty of pictures that you happen to get while you're out there, and they could be great pictures, but it has to be a great picture for the story we're doing. That picture may find a life later on in some other project, but we won't run it because it's a beautiful picture. We'll run it if it is vitally necessary to our narrative and it carries the narrative well. hopefully in a page-turner sort of way, you know, that when people turn the page, they stop and they pay attention.
My guest today is Jim Richardson, a photographer for National Geographic magazine and a contributing editor to Traveler, their companion magazine. Some of his work is part of the National Geographic's Greatest Photographs of the American West, which is on display through February 3rd at Gilcrease Museum. Let's talk about the photographs that are in the exhibit. The first one is a fairly recent story. It's about the night skies. Mm-hmm. And this was at Natural Bridges National Monument. Mm-hmm. And you have a night image of one of the natural bridges. And it's a nighttime shot with the Milky Way in the background. This is a gorgeous shot. And, of course, Utah is one of those places where you have that really, truly black mm-hmm. environment at night.
And they've got some landscapes, don't they?
They do have some landscapes. Tell us something about this picture. Why that particular arch to tell the story of the night sky?
That particular place, Natural Bridges National Monument, because that is the first dark sky preserve in the United States. And we're doing a story about light pollution, about the way that we're losing our age-old human heritage of the dark skies, being able to see the stars, you know, see the Milky Way. And I wanted a place where you could still see the Milky Way, and that's a great place. It's also a place that has the ancillary advantages being protected and held in reserve, if you will, for future generations so that they can go to someplace like that and see it. But most of all, because it would make a great picture. And for the beginning of our story, what I thought we needed to do was to establish in the minds of our readers what it is we're talking about when you say dark skies. Because what really happens is the darker the sky, the brighter the stars. You know, it's actually a sort of reverse effect. And all of a sudden, the Milky Way is not some vague name in a crooner's ballad. It's a real thing up there.
It's really our galaxy. And I think people will go out in the country and they think they're in dark skies. But mm-hmm. unless you're away from a lot of cities, mm-hmm. you're still getting light pollution from cities 100 miles, 50 miles away.
Oh, yes, very much.
And really, Utah, I think, is the first time I really saw a truly dark sky.
It's very, very difficult to find truly dark places. And it's unfortunate because the figure that is quoted, and I kind of believe it, is that 80% of the world's population alive today will never see the Milky Way again. Oh, it's kind of like saying, you know, the next time that you go back to the Grand Canyon, there's going to be a billboard in front of 80% of it, you know. It's a tragedy. I showed that picture in Saudi Arabia about a year and a half ago to a bunch of young people. And my guide, my interpreter who was helping me around, saw it on screen and leaned over to his friend and said, "What is that?"
You know, even in Saudi Arabia.
Had never seen it and didn't know what it was, didn't know that we live in the middle of a galaxy, didn't know that you can see it with your naked eye. Yeah, it's a sad reckoning of where we have come. So that's what this story was about.
I would imagine on that photograph you probably get a lot of questions like, how did you enhance that? Mm-hmm. And was it really enhanced?
No, it's not enhanced. You can. It was enhanced in one way, if you think of it, you know. In order that we could see the arch, we lit the arch at night. And we light a lot of things, you know. There's nothing wrong with that. But what I did was I had an assistant who was over crouching underneath a bush with a flashlight. And when you use a modern camera that has incredible sensitivity to low light, it doesn't take much of a flashlight to light up a big landscape. And so he could, during the 90-second exposure that we were doing, he could shine that flashlight back and forth across the arch and light up the whole thing. And since it was a digital camera, I can see immediately the result and say, no, it's too bright on one end, and you need to put more light on the other end, and et cetera. All the time, the Milky Way is rising. And we don't think of that so much, except you think about, we're used to the moon rising. If you're a bit more into it, you're used to seeing
the planets,
Venus in the evening and then set. But the Milky Way does the same thing for the same reason. We're sitting on Earth, and it's spinning. And so while we were doing that, the Milky Way was rising, and we kept lighting it. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. By about 4 o'clock, the first glow of sunlight in the east began to wash out the sky, and the night was over for us.
Yeah, well, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous photograph.
It was fun to do.
The other picture that's in the exhibit is one of those iconic National Geographic images, and it's from a story on the, I guess, was it on the Ogallala Aquifer?
I think you're talking about the one from the Great Plains story.
Great Plains story.
Right.
Yeah, this is in the sand hills of Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And it's two ranchers or farmers.
Ranch hands?
Yeah. Watching a thunderstorm roll in.
Yeah. Yeah. Come over the top of them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That, we were on the Haythorne Ranch. It's up in the sand hills of Nebraska and Arthur County. They actually put up hay with draft horses on that ranch. It's a wonderful place to see.
Is it sort of like a heritage ranch, or is that just
no,
the way they
I
do
mean,
it
they,
normally? Yeah,
they
yeah.
sell horses for big money.
Yeah. Okay.
No, it's a big ranch. And so we were out there haying, and we saw this storm coming. And the first thing they did was get the draft horses and head for the barn. And then as it rolled in more, the clouds were a really deep green, you know, the kind of color that if you've lived on the Great Plains and you see green clouds, you go, okay, this is serious, folks.
Yeah.
Coming at them, there were great swirling patterns all around, and these guys just stopped for a moment, stood there, you know, hands dropped at their sides, gaping up at it. I was behind them, and I just dropped down and did a couple of pictures of them looking up at the clouds. And there were plenty of other pictures that I did around all of that, you know. But something about their gesture, about the clouds, the nature of the light, all of it. Anyway, it all comes together. I can't say that I knew that's exactly what I meant to do, because I didn't go out there thinking a storm was coming. But one of the jobs of a photographer is to be attuned to what needs to be said. And we can't concoct it. We can only find it. And so there is a certain ballet of response and being in step with the times and the moments and what we are offered that is where the pictures come from. And if you do it right, you know, you recognize something. When I guess when those ranchers looked up at that and looked at that, I've seen my father do that on the farm. I've seen farmers do it ever since. You know, farmers and ranchers spend a lot of time
outdoors, you know, watching the weather.
Outdoors, watching the weather at the beck and call, at the mercy of the weather. And since I knew that, I knew it in my heart, I recognized it.
Let me ask you, you've done a whole bunch of stories in the West from the Ogallala Aquifer, which mm-hmm. is, of course, how do you take pictures of the Ogallala? you can only show what people do with the water for
right.
the most part. But Mount St. Helens, what has been the most unusual places you found yourself taking pictures for a documentary story?
Oh, I would suppose perhaps up on Mount Baker amongst the steaming vents of the volcano. It's kind of a fun place to be, you know, getting to go land a helicopter in the great cavity of Mount St. Helens where it blew up is a bit of a hoot. I will say that.
Yeah, no.
inside the turbines of Grand Coulee Dam when they were working on them. Not all the tourists get to go in there, I must say. Yeah. A number of places like that, yeah.
Yeah. My guest today is Jim Richardson, a photographer for National Geographic magazine. Several of his images are a part of National Geographic's Greatest Photographs of the American West. The book, he has even more of his work. It's on display through February 3rd at Gilcrease Museum. I want to ask about your fascination with the little town of Cuba, Kansas. You've been photographing this place for how many years? 30?
35 years now, I suppose.
What captures your attention about Cuba, Kansas? Where is Cuba, Kansas, for that
Cuba
matter?
Is in north central Kansas. Okay. Cuba's a town of about 300. Well, it was 300 when I started going there. It's about 200 people now.
I said north of Salina?
North of Salina, about 90 miles.
Yeah.
Right.
I think I've
almost
been through
10 miles
once.
From the Nebraska border, you know. I guess the fascination with it was that it was the kind of stuff that you would write a novel out of. It was the kind of, it was everyday life. There's nothing journalistic to recommend it. It's not the largest or smallest or anything
prototypical
that you could that you could pitch to a magazine and get them to pay attention. But it was a place of real life, and it was rich. It is rich. It's rich in life. It's rich in people who know how to make community happen. It's rich in people who know how to have fun. And probably that's why they have good community. Mm-hmm. You know, people will come to Cuba from other towns to be part of the Cuba community because you have a good time in Cuba. And it feels like life is happening
even,
all around you.
Even as a town, as you're watching it, what, drop by a third over those 35 mm-hmm. years?
Mm-hmm. Yep, they've managed to keep a lot of that going. Even in the same time that they lost their high school, old Doc McClaskey, who was there for 52 years, died. The implement dealer had to move away. The blacksmith shop fell down after Joe Sterba died. And then some 20 years later, they put it back up and they've restored it. They've moved the old one-room school back down on Main Street. They got a grant for $375,000 to restore the community hall and make a senior citizen center and a place for dances and roller skating and wedding receptions and polka dances and the whole thing.
So you're watching this little small town hold on, basically.
They're holding on, that's right. And doing it not by the usual sorts of economic development things, but by drawing on whatever resource they have of the people they have. And that's really the heartening thing, is that when it really does come down to it, all they've got is each other, you know, really. And it's a great lesson. It's a great lesson for the cynical side that wants to analyze everything in the usual economic models of our times, to find that these folks who are relying on each other are able to put something together and make it happen.
What's the reaction to you as a photographer that comes to the town fairly regularly mm-hmm. and starts snapping shots of everything?
Well, I've been around there long enough that I'm part of the community. I'm
right.
no longer an objective observer.
Right.
Over all of that time, I have given up the idea of objectivity. I haven't given up truthfulness or the idea that you can't just trumpet your own biases. But I think that what I learned there was that there are human stories which will not succumb to the fly-on-the-wall sort of approach, that unless you in some way enter into the life to become subjective about it, you will never understand why it works, what's driving things, why things matter. And that has happened to me there. So I'm part of the community, have been for a long time now, and I make no bones about it. I tell people that directly. And out of the pictures comes a view of people who have, in a place that's not very wealthy, it is struggling, that is not at all what you would think of as a successful place in America. They have fashioned their own kind of success.
What is the community's reaction to what they see you take photographs of?
I think that
is it a bit of a curiosity. Is it?
Oh no! They like the pictures.
Yeah.
CBS News Sunday Morning has been out twice
sure.
now, and it's been published in National Geographic and American Photo
any
number of places. There is a validation for them. And the validation is very simple, and I wish that all peoples could have this sort of validation. And basically, it says you're worthy, because so much of our life and our contemporary landscape enthrones the celebrities and the powerful and the rich, and there needs to be some way in which you take everyday folk the everyday life, the commonplace, the things that we all do in common, and hold it up and say, this is worthy. You know, the kind of experiences that we all have, raising our children, you know, facing life and marriage and romance, and old age and death and all those things, you know, the things that we understand as the rightful ground of novels, you know, somewhere that's my subject matter on this, and it does seem to affect them that way.
You've certainly, as part of covering the Great Plains, you've seen a lot of little communities like Cuba, maybe a little further west, that have, you know, nature's reclaimed a lot of those places.
That's right.
And I'm sure covering the Great Plains, I'm sure that article mentioned the Popper's theory of, you know, the Great Plains returning to wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Do you worry about that for a place like Cuba, or is Cuba the exception?
In many ways, I'm of two minds. I would say that the community isn't the buildings. The community is the people.
Right.
If the people are there and they value and they benefit from the community, then all efforts to keep that going, if it's rich and rewarding, then it's worth saving. But there's also no reason not to celebrate the fact that great swatches of the Great Plains, and particularly the High Plains, might be returning to what you might call wilderness. When I was growing up, there were no deer in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big news when people started seeing deer. And now there are deer everywhere. Turkeys have come back. Mountain lions are coming back. Elk. It's really, really quite amazing. It makes the landscape richer. I'm also not of the opinion that it's one or the other. I'm of the opinion that mankind is and has always been a part of nature. We are not separate from. And the real goal is to learn how to live together in all this. We are here. We are going to affect the landscape. And if there was a great swatch of prairie out there that became a huge bison preserve, it could be a huge economic engine as well as something else. But I'm pretty comfortable with letting processes take their course.
Jim Richardson, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
National Geographic photographer Jim Richardson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Two of his images are included as a part of the National Geographic's Greatest Photographs of the American West exhibit, which is on display through February 3rd at Gilcrease Museum. If you'd like to see more of his photography, you can visit his website, jimrichardsonphotography.com, or if you're ever near Wichita, you can visit his gallery in person. It's the Small World Gallery in Lindsborg, Kansas, about an hour north of Wichita. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.